Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, welcome to Film Fandango, the film podcast. My name is David Reed, hosting you through the world of cinema with my good friend Marek Larwood. Hello, Marek.
Hello, David. What voice was that?
I don't know. I was just trying something. It was sort of pockish. Sort of like a bard or minstrel.
Would you like to play a minstrel or a bard? Who would you play in a Shakespeare of all of the parts?
All the parts in all the Shakespeares in all the world.
Answer immediately.
I would like to play Macbeth. No, it's rubbish, isn't it? Hamlet.
Yeah.
Who would you play? I mean, you're a born bottom. Do you not like that casting type?
Oh, what idiot!
Oh, he's not an he's a comedian, isn't he? He's a funny character.
I like to play someone sophisticated.
Okay.
Like who's the one? The gadget one, Q.
He's not in Shakespeare, mate.
What?
No. That's a different writer you're thinking of.
All right. Then,
I mean, there's as many of them, but they're not the same.
I'll play Bilbo.
I think you'd be a good Richard III. Actually, I think you've got a lot of anger in you.
Isn't he the most evil?
Yeah, he's the most evil character they've got, yeah.
Or I play something like one of the third men, you know, when there's a gang of men in a Merchant of Venice and there's
the third one.
You just hear there's like Bassanio or so,
yeah.
And there's like someone called Cassio or something.
I think you Cassio, yeah, that's right. Cassio 8310.
Yeah. I play Cassio.
Okay. You'd make a good Cassio. I could see you playing a good Sir Toby Belch as well. He's a fun character. I played him at school.
What's that in?
He's in Twelfth Night.
Oh, yeah.
He's the sort of high status drunk.
Yeah.
He's good.
Or Wilmot Brown.
Again, I don't think that's Shakespeare.
It's EastEnders.
Oh, that's it. Yeah.
The guy who owned the wine bar he sexually assaulted Kathy Beery did worse than that.
Okay.
I don't want to play him.
Well, someone's already done that. I don't think they do remakes of... God, that would be a thing.
They do remakes.
The Marvel Studios go back and remake EastEnders from the beginning.
They do the whole... They do the Den and Anne story.
Right.
In an hour and a half. As a whole film.
A whole film.
Someone's going to do it.
It's going to happen eventually. I mean, we have enough culture, guys. Can't we just rehash the old culture now? Nothing about it being relevant to the modern day.
You did something very interesting.
You can't prove a thing.
With your dog.
Yeah, that's right, I did. As regular listeners will be aware, the Picture House Central in London is my go-to cinema currently. And they had an event where owners could go with their dogs to the cinema to see a special screening of Heart of a Dog, which is a film by Laurie Anderson, the widow of Lou Reed. And she's an artist in her own right, and a poet as well. And this is a very different film, actually. It's more like an art piece than a sort of feature film, as you'd understand it or expect to go see. But I knew nothing about it going in. But, yeah, so I took Buddy down to the Picture House Central, and I can show you the photos, Marek. I'll put these up on our Facebook page.
Oh, they are lovely.
We're on the Picture House Facebook page.
So how does it work? Are the dogs allowed to sit on the seats?
Yeah, as you can see from this photo, this is, I went along with a friend of the show, Lizzie Roper, who hasn't been on in a while, but they put blankets on every third or fourth seat, and the dogs come in, and they come along and get their own seat. And I was expecting, I have to admit, I bought a ticket because I thought it was going to be absolute carnage.
Did you have to buy a separate ticket for your dog as well?
No, just
even though
humans.
It takes up two seats?
That's right, yeah. So I thought it was going to be carnage and be worth just watching this completely ill-thought-out thing fail, as it was just dogs barking at each other throughout a film we couldn't watch. And you know what? I couldn't have been more wrong. It was lovely. We all arrived at the lobby.
How many dogs were there, first of all?
Every third or fourth seat in a packed house.
And did they, was there barking and...
Every now and again, but in the lobby, they were all getting on like a house on fire, having a lovely time. They just like being around big crowds. We go into the auditorium where obviously there's low lighting, and we go along rows and we find our seat. And I promise you, they all immediately curled up on the seat and went to sleep as the lights came down for the film to start. They were all just doing their classic behaviour of sitting on the sofa with their owners at home. Like, they all just went to sleep. They were so much better behaved than your average View or Cineworld viewer.
That's incredible.
They, I would happily...
Is it the light thing, then? That they react to the lights going down?
And just sort of your body language of you're sitting down, you know, ready to be there for a while, they go to sleep.
Weren't they hassling people eating popcorn and things like that?
The dogs had their own popcorn. There was dog popcorn on every seat.
What?
Little bags of dog popcorn. So
what is
I
dog
settled
popcorn?
Him. It's popcorn is fine for them, but it's without the high salt or sugar content, so it's got flavourings of, I think it was seaweed or something, and just little things that they like. But yeah, so settled Buddy down with the little treats of dog popcorn to distract him until the film started, and then we fell asleep. I would happily sit in a screening with dogs and their owners rather than normal people at the cinema. They were so much better behaved.
Was this the first time they've done this dog thing, or not? Is it
in the city, in the Picture House? Yeah, they Laurie Anderson has done it in a couple of other places. She's actually organised a concert for dogs with Yo-Yo Ma.
Oh wow!
And apparently, then they added, you know, lots of high notes, so there's more for them to get out of it. But she knows it's a naff and sort of ludicrous thing to attempt, but there's just something quite nice about doing it once, you know. So she's done it a couple of times, but not really. Her film is about the loss of her dog, Lola Bell, and about grieving and death generally, which of course...
That must be really depressing, watching that when you've got your own dog next to you.
It's not a depressing film in that regard. Okay. No, it's about appreciation and memory and love, and it's quite... but it goes into memories of her own mother, and it actually talks about the death in a very positive way, but in everyone in her life apart from Lou Reed. So it isn't a sort of celebrity cash-in, and I think that's been incredibly important to her. The final frame of it is just a dedication to him, but the rest of it is just about the other deaths in her life, but in a positive way, you know, celebration of them, their lives, really.
Is it a good film, or do you think has she used the dog... Can you only see it if you've got a dog with you?
No. There's plenty that isn't about dogs at all. You know, in fact, the majority of it isn't really
about
dogs.
Who chose to have it, make a dog screen? The cinema?
She did. She did, and she approached the cinema about it. Now, she is very good with words, and the music is all hers as well. The soundtrack is like one continuous piece. And some people will find it too wanky, because it isn't a story in the same way. The whole thing's narrated by her, and it's sort of sound and images and short stories that she's telling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about 90 minutes, just over. But if you sort of accept it as what it is, of not your usual cinema experience, it's very well done. She's got a real turn of phrase, and there's some beautiful bits. Really, really beautiful. But it's just that surreal thing. If you're all sat there with your dogs... And it's no problem at all.
Do people feel, is there a sort of warmer, do you think the audience were warmer towards the film because there was an appreciation that you've, that she's allowed this to happen?
I think so.
So you feel different when you're
watching
it. I think
that's right, because as a dog owner, especially in London, I think it's different in smaller towns and villages, but in London, you're not welcome in many places. You know, you're far more welcome with a screaming baby than you are with a well-behaved dog.
Mm.
You know, you can't go into a little corner shop, you can't go into a pharmacy, you can't go into a supermarket, you can't go into most restaurants, you can't go anywhere. You know, and also in London, I wouldn't tie up my dog outside and go into the shop because he'll be stolen. It happens.
Mm.
So it was nice to be able to go to a big public event and be welcomed as, you know, it's only you guys here. I mean, that's quite nice. But no, I mean, they seem to enjoy it just being around a big pack of people. That's all they get out of it. But Buddy has seen a film at the cinema, so that's the first. That was all that was quite exciting for Film Fandango listeners.
I think it's fascinating, because if you told me about it before, I was convinced it was going to be total chaos.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And it was anything but. There was a couple of, you know, yaps from one corner to the other, you know, of just the couple of dogs who weren't in the mood. But
was there barking in the film?
No, actually, not a lot. Every now and again. And in fact, in the logo of the production company that made it, there is a bark. And all the dog owners were like, you're all right, you could have muted that. You just feel it palpably in the room, you know.
I would like to see the reaction if there was real barking on the screen.
Well, it's funny, actually. Sometimes, because I'm an avid watcher of Game of Thrones, and that has quite a bit of barking every now and again. And it's sometimes Buddy will react to it, and sometimes just as if nothing's happening. So it must be about the
pitch of the TV, of
it.
Yeah.
Or about, it could be about what that bark means.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I can't believe...
I mean, most of them mean sausages, don't
sausages?
They?
Sausages? Question mark?
I like to think that 90% of them is the word sausages.
Sausages. It's, I don't think they get a lot out of cinema. I think it's a medium for us monkeys, but...
How much were the tickets more expensive?
No, they were fairly reasonable, actually, and I'm a member there, so I got a discount. But Lizzie Roper, who, for those who've been listening for a long time, brought in World's Greatest Dad, which is a film that we very much enjoyed. She doesn't have a dog, she's got cats, but she came along because she likes dogs and she wanted to see what it was like. And yeah, it was just like, fine, no problem. Quite a weird experience, but nice to have done.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
And Heart of a Dog, it's a very different experience. I think it's not for everybody, but I found it quite beautiful.
Like Marley and Me, but a documentary.
Yeah, a bit like Marley and Me. Yeah, yeah. Only with more sort of in-depth analysis of the soul and bereavement. There's a bit too much Buddhism in there for me, just off the peg, to make it truly truly revelatory. But no, it's good. It's good. She's a good writer.
Well, should we go to, how many Davies should you give it?
7.
Should we go to
this?
Here's a letter from Christopher Dodd. He's writing in a bit, isn't he?
He is a Christopher Dodd character. I mean, he's the new Christopher on the block.
What happened to Christopher? He's not written in for a while.
No, we'll see what happens.
We'll have to stop mentioning him soon, Christopher. Yeah.
Well, friend of the show, Christopher Dodd.
Hi, guys. Have you noticed in today's films a lack of emotional moments? Those special interactions between characters which just say so much. Today's film, I can seem to have forgotten them totally. For instance, take the film Steptoe and Son, a comedy. But about halfway through, when Harold receives a letter from his wife, there's a really touching moment between him and his dad where they realise she's leaving him. The camera slowly pans onto each of their faces. There's a hint of the Steptoe and Son theme in the background, but played purely on the piano. It's such a sad, emotional scene, right there in the middle of a comedy film. Or how about when Superman cradles the body of Lois Lane, after she had been crushed by the earthquake in the first Superman film. Such a gentle, tender scene. Again, right there, in the middle of a superhero film. am I missing these moments in modern film? If so, could you please point them out to me? P.S. I've not forgotten about the bumming man. It's just my therapist told me not to think about this for film for a few weeks. Apparently it was damaging my progress. Get lost, Dodd. The bumming man is only a force of good. Anyway, back to the question.
Question in hand. I think there is a general trend, and I don't think it's just me being old and going, films were better in the past, where big, brash blockbusters don't give the character moments the time of day anymore. And I don't think it's just the sad moments. I think it's all the moments. They're now shot like music videos more. I mean, not obviously as with as many shots, but it's more towards that style of just like, show the thing and move on quickly. And it's not about that character experiencing anything. I thought a prime example from modern cinema is The Force Awakens, where not a single character beat was given the time it actually needed to land.
Well, this is really... I was talking about this only the other day with a writer who's got two kids who are 9 and 7, and he showed them the original Star Wars. He was quite a big Star Wars fan.
Yeah.
And they found it slow and boring.
Yeah.
Whereas The Force Awakens, they found it really much better, and they enjoyed it much more because the actual... I think the pace, their brains are so wide, this quick cut, because the amount of time between each cut, someone's done studies, and that's gone down to, you know, 1 second, where it used to be 3 seconds or something like that.
I've watched some kids' TV for work that Danielle's been doing recently, and the pace of it is unwatchable at times, you know. It's
they're used to watching things, they find slower things boring.
Yeah.
So they're trained their brains to have these slow emotional things. Also, I think now, whereas opposed to in films, we talked about Rocky last week, we talked about, you know, in a lot of blockbusters there were the sad emotional things.
Yeah.
Now it seems to be a separate category.
It does. There seems, I mean, to be, if you remember
the teen cancer
films,
there's been a few and they are real weepy films.
Yeah.
So you're going especially to see that. They're not mixing up the genres.
I think you're right. I mean, if you think about Gremlins, it has that weird scene in the middle where Phoebe Cates talks about how her dad died on Christmas Eve, climbed down the chimney dressed as Santa. And you go... And it's so strange. And I read an article, I think I've talked about it before, where Steven Spielberg, who was producing, said, I do not know why this scene is in here. If it was me, I would cut it. But it's your film. Do what you like. But I just want you to know, I do not understand why it's there. And you know what? It works, because it just gives you this... just like, breathe out in the middle of all of this carnage that just... means that you care so much more about the people going through all of this nonsense. But it's like an interval to reconnect with your characters who have just been chased by nonsense puppets for the last hour, you know. And I think you're right. You wouldn't put that scene into a film you knew was explicitly targeted at kids. I think in the past they just went, kids are going to love this, but it's for everyone, I guess. You know, just make it. And there's now a vocabulary of filmmaking for children. You know, with every decade that's gone on, there's more films to draw on and copy and go, oh, we should do that, oh, we should do that. The original Star Wars films, and certainly the first one, is copying films for adults, really. It's old westerns and war films and Kurosawa films, you know. It's got the vocabulary of cinema is from very adult genres. And now they've got 30, 40 years of films to go on and just go, no, we can do fast stuff. Do fast stuff because kids like fast. Because if there's an emotional pause, they don't understand it. They're not sophisticated enough to get what this might be. They don't have their own experiences to draw on and recall in those moments, you know.
What's really interesting, I mean, talking about filmmaking, I'm watching a lot of YouTube things. And there's a vlogger called Casey Neistat, who's American, he's 35. He's a filmmaker, and a few years ago, or a year or so ago, started to make a film a day. And what's really interesting about his films, all the kids watch them, but he uses a lot of drone footage and he does some time lapses. And he does some really beautiful cinematography.
Right.
Some types are quite slow. There's always a time lapse there. There's always a slow thing, and it really gives it this feel, this city, and this. It's very cinematic.
Yeah.
And that's sort of gone through into. I mean, some of this footage wouldn't be out of place in cinema. This is a drone. It's the same drones they use.
Yeah.
And that's got the time. It's got the. And what makes these vlogs, which are all 10 minutes long, which originally. 3 or 4 years ago, you try and make an internet film. I remember talking to people about, I made these Boris ones for Yahoo a few years ago, and everyone says, kids, they've only got 3 minutes, they've only got 3 minutes, it's got to be 3 minutes. And arguing, someone saying, this bit, if it's funnier, if it's 4 minutes, you've got the pauses, and the pauses make the uncomfortable silence, and it has to be longer.
Yeah, unless
and he's doing this thing that the kids are watching.
But let's be sensible. The kids are watching because it's funny. The kids aren't watching because it's under 3 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, lots of things are under 3 minutes and not worth watching. You can't just focus on that. You've got to actually focus on the comedy.
But I'm making sort of 2 points. Really. My other point is the sort of beauty. I think kids are watching this stuff and it's beautiful. That's a whole part of it. That this time, whether we're imposing our sense of what kids need, we're programming the kids to have short attention spans rather than them. Half of it's the filmmaker's fault for not teaching them the slow things.
Yeah,
I really think that's, it's not just one way kids have got small attention spans. It's us, or not us, you know, people creating the content, creating those attention spans.
And I think it's bad for those kids, you know, to not give them these moments they don't quite understand yet, because that's how you learn. I mean, we're both comedians, so presumably as kids we watched a lot of comedy. And I've gone back and revisited some of my favourite things that I've watched again and again and again as a kid, and suddenly realised I didn't know what that joke was about. I still like the rhythm of it, and the words have stuck in my head, so I've learnt what they mean because they were there, but I still liked it. And If there isn't more for you to understand as a kid, if it's all just like, here's everything you already know fed back to you, that is not what a good parent should do. And society should be a good parent for all its kids, I guess.
2001, for example, that's a slow film.
It's a slow film for a lot of adults, 2001.
Yeah, but it really creates that sense of space.
Yeah.
This lonely, slow place.
Mm.
The pace, you know, the timing creates this feeling which is unusual and almost puts you into this sort of dreamlike lull state, I think, watching it, because it's so slow. And
it
so
doesn't seem at the pace of a single person's life. It feels at the pace of humanity, doesn't it? It's like we're just seeing snapshots of a far longer timeline here. It's a brilliant film. I think you're right. The pace is slow, but I don't think it's ever boring. There's always something weird happening or something for you to go, what?
A film with a different pace I saw, I mentioned earlier on the year, one of the best films of the year so far was that Rams, the Icelandic one, was about the two brothers and their rams. I loved the pace of that.
Yeah.
I really felt I don't need someone. I like to go to the cinema to sort of not look at my phone, to feel absorbed in something. And sometimes it's easier to do that with slower cuts.
Yeah. I think going back to the original question about these emotional moments as well, deaths is one where we've seen so many films that leading up to the climactic section will kill off a character you like in order to give it that dive down, so we've got the furthest to travel to the victory. It's a trick, but it works if we're invested. If we're not invested, it seems like we're being manipulated. But because so many films have done it now, they just copy the beats but try to do it in as short a time as possible.
Like, Force Awakens is a perfect
example of that. But it's not the only example of that. Mm. You know, it seems like, well, we saw them die and we saw a shot of someone looking sad, we can move on. You just go, that's not death. That's not death to anyone. Like, how are they? It's the number of films where they go no over the love of their life or their best friend or their parent or whatever, and then 10 minutes later, having defeated the baddie, they're high-fiving their best mate, riding into the sunset, and you go, "Aren't you still bereaved? Like, this is just nonsense, isn't it? This is just nonsense."
That's why Truly Madly Deeply is such a brilliant film, because it deals with that whole. The first thing is it's not bereavement; it's shock.
Yeah.
And then bereavement comes in way this sort of horrible waves that hit you.
It's a brilliant film,
and that's sort of, and that, and it's time and the film they can never really deal. It's hard to deal with because death and bereavement is such a length of time, isn't it? How do you manage to show that length of time in an hour and a half?
Yeah. Well, no, I'm not saying that as soon as somebody dies, the rest of the film should be about bereavement. That would get very tiresome, I think. But going back to big blockbuster films like... if we're using The Force Awakens as an example of who does it wrong, then let's look at Star Wars as an example that does it right. Exact same thing, where Obi-Wan Kenobi gets killed and he has been a father figure to Luke and also his only link to his real father in the past. That he knows of at the time. Mm. And so, really, the father he never knew is dying again because Obi-Wan is the only one who can tell him about him, you know. And then you've got them all regrouping on the Millennium Falcon having escaped, and Luke is sort of, you know, he's feeling it. He's feeling it for at least a scene, you know, in the next one. They're still getting on with other stuff and talking about what they're going to do, but it feels like it's not just tricks. It feels like it's the story's being told. And I suppose that's the difference. There's no hard and fast way of doing it, but it's not just copied a film that's done this before, so we all get what's going on. It's actually trying to make you feel it.
Mm.
And I think that's the difference.
I mean, it's interesting about how maybe films seem fickle because human life, so just sort of there's no effect of someone dying, so it doesn't really...
You mean in terms of globalised society in an information age?
I try to make a quite bigger point. I don't know what it is. I mean, okay, I might just want to know a letter.
Fair enough. Okay, this is from James and it's come through our website, filmfandango.co.uk. Or com. I don't know how to say that, man. It's so boring. Right. James says, "Hey, lads, don't do a voice. Pisses me right off when I have to rewind to work out what the hell you're saying." It's a fair point. Excellent podcast all the same. Can't remember you talking about docs on BBC iPlayer, and I think now is as good slash important a time as ever. It's where I first discovered Cartel Land and have just watched Into the Limelight, a lovely look at rock tribute acts in a crew, club, and arena from 1997. Not groundbreaking, but if you're familiar with the underground, struggling music scene, David, I'm sure you'll love. I donate, but I'm off to the bank to ask if they'll increase my £3,000 overdraft tomorrow, as on Sunday I won't be able to pay my weekly rent. To say, I'm an actor. Keep watching the films.
Well, good luck, James. I hope you get some money.
Yeah.
I hope you get an advert which will pay approximately just under £3,000.
Just under. Sorry to hear that, James. Film Fandango is free so that everyone can listen to it, I guess. Documentaries on the iPlayer. I've not actually gone to the iPlayer for documentaries. Yeah, you've seen Cartel Land, though.
I reviewed it a few weeks ago. I thought it was painted a very dark picture of Mexico.
Yeah.
Why not tune in to our podcast about 3-4 weeks ago?
Look and for it.
Hear me blunder through another review of that.
Sure. If you go to acast.com/filmfandango, there's a list of all of them there, and in the descriptions it says the films we talk about, so you'll be able to find it in there.
I'll go on to the next letters actually related similar okay. thing. In the voice of Ian McCaskill, I can't do that. Hey, David Marek, buddy, impossible guest. We must get some guests in.
We do.
Glad you both enjoyed all this mayhem. Aussies do a special line, slightly unhinged, wild-eyed, but likeable guys. Chopper, Steve Irwin, Taz, the crazy Australian dog guy. He's put a YouTube clip in there. Another sports doc recommendation. I'm sure you're aware Netflix has released Team Foxcatcher recently. I read that really badly, sorry. Well worth a watch, even if you haven't seen the movie that came out last year. It really strikes me that the director of the movie panicked and toned down the script so it wouldn't seem unbelievable as some of the stuff depicted in the doc goes beyond what they included. There's a sort of mild spoiler scene here. Anyway, keep watching the films, Henry. What I did was I watched 4 documentaries on Netflix, so I'll take you through them sort of quickly.
Yeah, I do.
And did you see Foxcatcher?
I didn't. It's this Channing Tatum, Steve Carell wrestling,
Mark Ruffalo thing. It's a famous story about this really connected, rich but weird heir to a fortune who decided to get involved in a bloke called John E. DuPont, who was a weird mother sort of figure, not too dissimilar from some sort of psycho character, really.
Okay.
And he invested in the American wrestling scene and created his own weird American wrestling base camp next to his mansion, and got all these international wrestlers in to try and make America win the Olympic wrestling.
Right.
And then there's something very, very peculiar, as you probably saw about in the Steve Carell performance. I think you don't really need to watch the film. It's very similar to the film. Obviously, it's a documentary of it. So, yeah. And in my head, I thought the theme was the film might have been overly stylized with the with tracksuits, with a fox catcher on it. But he actually had those, and I thought maybe Steve Carell was playing it too big, the performance. But this John E. DuPont is a very, very strange man who's got serious issues that are a dark side that is the underbelly of his philanthropy.
You don't see.
It's a fascinating documentary. It would have been better, probably, if I hadn't seen the film.
Because you knew what was coming.
You know exactly what's going to happen. What they did was, in the film, is interesting, they put Channing Tatum as the brother of Mark Ruffalo.
Yeah.
But in the actual events, the guy who Channing Tatum sort of alluded to playing is a Russian a wrestler, not his brother at all. So I don't know why they did that. But it's very peculiar things of them just literally all these, this odd world, all these macho wrestlers just there. And he, John E. DuPont, wants to become a wrestler as well. So they all have to pretend, because he's funding it all.
Yeah.
They all have to pretend that he's wrestling these Olympic quality wrestlers, and he's a 60-year-old man trying to get fit.
And they're all living in the grounds of his house.
It's very odd and very peculiar. He becomes increasingly more paranoid. It's a fascinating story. I think what's great is on, we talked about this before, we're seeing a whole a load of documentaries because of the video footage is more and more available.
Yeah. Well, and everyone's filming everything all the time.
Yeah.
So there's enough footage to make something after the event you didn't know was building to.
Yeah, with incredible stories. The other ones I saw, so Foxcatcher, I give it 7 marks. That's a good watch. Another really interesting one is called Red Army.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the story of Slava Fetisov, who, in the 1980s, ice hockey became the most popular sport in the Soviet Union. And they had this uber, the greatest team ever. A bit like, if you know football, there's the Dutch side playing total football, where they'd all pass it and they revolutionised the game. Suddenly there was a Soviet team where all the defenders are attacking, and you watch clips of them play, they're just like ballerinas, really, just skating around the ice, destroying the American sides. They're playing all these, because there was quite a lot of money in the American game even then. They're going on tour, beating the Canadians, and
I hadn't heard about that.
The Americans want to get these Russian players. Obviously, they're all in the Russian army, because they all play for the Red Army Soviet team. And they suddenly experience this American life they're not used to, like shops full of food. It's just the very end of the Cold War.
Yeah.
When at sort of 1989, when I can't remember exactly when Gorbachev steps down. So you've got the stories of this team and how they potentially defect to America to play. So it's sport combined with history, which is fascinating.
Yeah.
And the bloke who's this Slava Fetisov, they interview him. He comes across as a real cold. He could easily be the villain in the Bond film. There's something, they put these bits in the documentaries on purpose, I think, to show that he's a bit of an arsehole.
Yeah.
Where he's on his phone and he's stopping the person from saying, "Hang on, it's business. Let me finish business. Then I'll speak." And because maybe it's his understanding of English. That he's very, very blunt. There's no manners. It's just a matter of fact. There's no... He just says everything really bluntly and disagrees with things if he's got any objection to it. So it's fascinating seeing a difficult star. Someone who's... We're so used to seeing these media-trained sportsmen who don't really have opinions.
Yeah.
to we're seeing someone who came from the Soviet Union, who's in his 50s now, who's now a sports minister under Putin, talking with doing exactly what he wants. He's quite an interesting character. Anyway, it's nice to see that the undercurrent. It's not just sport. You've got the whole of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and you find out how they used to train people differently, the things they put them through. It's interesting. Another Seven Marics.
Great.
And then, in contrast to that, there's one called, I watched Iverson, about Allen Iverson, who's, I was a big basketball fan, and I missed him. He was the player from the sort of ghettos, really, from the projects, who rose to fame and became the basketball star at around 2003, 2004. He was only 6 foot. So in the NBA, when they're 6'11", you know, 7 foot. And it's interesting because you're supposed to feel sorry for him. He's from the projects and he's difficult, but I just think, well, maybe you're just an arsehole. Do you know what I mean? When they're trying to make him cool and likeable, and you think, well, I don't really feel sorry for you.
Yeah.
Because sportsmen aren't really interesting. That's the problem.
No, I mean, that is it, isn't it? I mean, they have spent a lot of time not talking to people, just getting their kicking and their throwing and their stuff right for their entire emotional and intellectual development. And they'll burn out in their 30s.
or they're giving money and have to deal with it and totally spoil.
Yeah, yeah. No, they're the odd subject of films, aren't they?
And this was a documentary where all of the interviewees were pro Iverson, pretty much.
Right.
You didn't see anyone slagging. It was all the sort of teachers who really liked him that he was all hard done by. There was no alternate story at all. And yet, there's something about, call me prejudiced, but if I see someone with tattoos on their neck, I instantly don't warm to people.
Well, I think that might be your thing, but I get that. So you think it's a bit of a polemic that might be a little far from the truth? You think he might just be a bit of an arsehole and that's why he was kept down? Or
he obviously did, you know, he made mistakes and he didn't handle it, and he had a really, really bad life, and he was treated badly, where he was in a fight at a bowling alley and they tried to ruin his career and he got put in jail for it because it was just the bunch of black kids fighting white kids, and all the black kids imprisoned. But it didn't really ever address any issue. I think the thing with dealing with these big personalities who are multimillionaires doing documentaries on them, the problem is they've got so many lawyers and people supporting them that to do a really truthful sort of warts and all documentary is quite a difficult thing to achieve.
And however true the stuff that makes it into it, if it feels polemic, then you start to distrust what everyone's saying.
Yeah.
So it could be that everything you're being told is true, but because you don't have the other side, and all human beings are both things.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, I can see that. So does it hamper your enjoyment of the documentary?
Yeah, I didn't think it was... I just didn't really think it was a warts and all documentary. It wasn't like... he ends up coming across worse.
So it feels like a backfiring propaganda piece about a man.
A little bit. Everyone's trying to be nice about him, but there isn't enough nice things to say to fill a documentary.
Okay.
And they just seem to be making excuses. A lot of people are making excuses for his behaviour.
Because he makes them very wealthy, presumably.
Yeah. And he had a hard life. He was an interesting player, but I didn't find it as enjoyable.
Hey, look,
some
people have had hard lives, are just assholes. I mean,
yeah,
I'm sorry for you, but you're still an asshole.
Yeah. And you've got to be the most valuable player of the NBA, so some of your dreams did come true.
Yeah,
which is pretty. So,
what are you still being an asshole for?
Yeah, I don't really understand why you're acting sad.
Yeah, well, is there a bit of self-pity going on?
I think so. I mean, everyone has a sense of self-pity, but
it's not an attractive trait, though, is it?
Especially if you've actually... It's the equivalent of me winning an Oscar.
Yeah.
And then trying to get people to sort of...
Well, it's been really hard.
Feel sorry that I got bit by a dog when I was six or something.
Yeah, yeah, I saw a video.
But that's a terrible example because his life is much harder than that.
Sure, sure. I mean, he went to prison. But I saw a video on Facebook that... You know how Facebook has just started playing videos if you accidentally loiter over the...
I can't stand it.
I know. But there was one of Justin Timberlake, who I've interviewed, actually. And he was doing some talk at some teen event thing about how... you should embrace your difference, and it's great being different, because he found it really tough growing up being different. He said, you weren't different. You were in the Mickey Mouse Club. You were the most popular boy at school, you lying prick.
Yeah.
And it's clearly a PR move to make him in, because it's cool to be the nerd these days.
Yeah.
Just go, you weren't different. I didn't believe a word of it. But there's a lot PR know about that. The self-pitying thing. To get people on side. Just go, yeah, to become the millionaire I am, I had a really tough journey.
It's just sub-stories that become... that are on Britain's Got Talent, these talent shows.
Yeah.
It's always, you know...
But when already successful people do it to tell you how their success is justified because they had it tough, you just go, oh, shut up.
Yeah. Get with the programme.
Yeah.
And the last documentary...
Oh, yeah.
Is a recommendation by I follow him on Twitter. It's at Tokyo Sex Whale.
Yes.
Named up, who
he's a graphic designer.
He's a graphic designer. Yeah, he's recommended some brilliant stuff before to us. And he, after I did my live film, unsuccessful film tweeting the other week, he recommended Finders Keepers. So I watched it immediately. So follow him at Tokyo_sexworld, and as you can see, some brilliant graphic design. This is an incredible story.
What's it about? Is it one that I should know nothing about and just watch?
I can say something about it, but you can't. If you want to go and watch it, I would stop the podcast now, and then you can go and watch it and talk about it.
Okay, to those of you leaving us now, keep watching the films. Goodbye.
I'll just do a general description. It's a story about a man who had his leg amputated, the bottom half of his leg, and he couldn't find anywhere to store it. So he stored it. He wanted to keep it, to keep the bone, as a shrine to something that caused the accident in the first place.
Right.
Basically, there was an aircraft accident. Which is more quite tragic. He put it in one of these storage things in the stove of this storage thing because he kept it and it had mummified his leg. He wanted to keep it because it was his leg. He stopped paying the repayments on his storage thing. A bit like that storage that show. Someone bought the stove to find
a mummified leg in it.
Yeah. Now that's pretty weird. What makes this incredible is the characters in this film.
Okay.
The guy's family who's lost his leg is quite tragic, and he's just a really likeable, but he's got a lot of problems and his family are quite mental.
Okay.
And the bloke who buys it, it's by the same people who made King of Kongs.
Right.
Where I found out for a conversation they had on Twitter, which has got the archetypal really bad villain and the loser guy. This also has got a brilliant villain in it. This bloke called Shannon or something of his really sort of porcine, bit vain, but one of these a sort of horrible narcissist. You can't see why he's a narcissist. And he insists... He's disgusting and an arsehole, and he's someone who buys things to make profit, and he's got no sense of... He's just not a nice person.
Yeah.
He insists that as he bought the stove, the leg is his property.
Ugh, why would he want to?
But because he wants to make money.
Oh, I see.
So he won't... gets into a legal dispute
over insisting a man's own leg
is his property,
Are you allowed to own body, human body parts?
Well, that's what it's the whole lot. Open up this whole
that's
can of
worms.
And then it's not just about that. It's about their characters.
Yeah, yeah.
It's about this bloke being this sort of really obese sort of narcissist with a sort of with a ignored wife, and the other bloke having his own demons. Where basically, he loses a family member in the crash and lost his leg, and he's got a bad drink and drug problem.
Right,
and it's very well made. It's just an incredible story and incredible characters. That sometimes it was all over the news, the big thing. It got into the papers over here.
Okay,
it's just a bit. It's only got a 2-star rating on Netflix. It's not a perfect documentary, but it's really nice after seeing the. It's always documentaries about sports stars or documentaries about a certain issue. It's refreshing to watch a documentary that's just a really weird story where you get to see how mental normal people are.
Yeah, yeah, they can be. So, recap the names of those four for us again so we can track them down.
Team Foxcatcher.
Yeah.
I would watch the film, you watch this or the film, because they're so similar.
I haven't seen the film, so I'll watch this.
Yeah, watch the documentary. Iverson, I just think if you like basketball, it's otherwise it's not really that interesting. Red Army is a fascinating account of ice hockey and sport and the collapse of Russia and America, that point in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
It does feel like it's Rocky sort of feel.
It's not long before the fall of the Soviet Union.
Yeah. And Finders Keepers is a fascinatingly mental story.
Amazing.
Of middle America, you know.
Amazing. All right, well, that's it for this week. If you'd like to get in touch, then please do so on our website, filmfandango.com, and you can go to the contact page and write to us from there. We will be back next week. Keep watching the films.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.